This is Three Interesting Things. Hello, and welcome to Three Interesting Things, a weekly podcast where we discuss the three most interesting things on the internet this week. I am your host, Don Grant. Joining me today, journalist for the Huffington Post covering technology and politics, also an adjunct professor of journalism at the University of Laverne, Jesselyn Cook. How are you doing, Jesselyn?
Hi, Don. Thanks so much for having me. I'm doing well.
Welcome to the show. It's funny, I was trying to think about how to sort of how to state what your beat is when it comes to journalism. And you talk about a lot about technology, you talk a lot about politics. But at the end of the day, what I sort of settled on is you kind of focus and cover on the war against misinformation. Is that too fine a point?
I think that's a good way to round it up, yeah.
So what has drawn you towards that beat the most? I mean, obviously, we are in a time where reporting on that kind of thing has never been more important. But what's made you gravitate towards that?
Yeah, I think you said it. It's just misinformation and disinformation has been flying around so much, especially towards the end of the Trump presidency. There was just too much to focus on. So this beat kind of drew me to it. I've shifted around a lot. I started covering world news at the beginning of my career, and then I shifted to women's issues, and this beat just felt natural with everything going on. So I've been doing this for about 2 years now.
It is interesting to cover world news again. I mean, I mentioned this on a podcast a couple of weeks ago, but whenever I'm in Europe, as I am frequently because of my wife, it's always interesting to see that there is other stuff being covered. You know what I mean? We've lived for 4 years in this entire bubble where Trump has sucked all the air out of the room, and that's the only thing being covered. That I know that whenever I'm in France or somewhere else, it's like, oh, yeah, there's other stuff going on in the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
And people are covering it. Anyway, today it's going to be a little bit of a different show in that we're going to be talking about two things instead of three things. But I promise, dear listener, we're going to make it worth your while because they are two rather significant things that require a little bit more space and air to breathe. Starting with thing number one. Thing one. Children of QAnon believers are desperately trying to de-radicalize their own parents. Now, we have talked about QAnon on this show before. It's definitely a subject that interests me tremendously. But this piece by you, Jesselyn, is, I have to say, as someone who has read a lot of QAnon pieces, I would put this in one of the top two or three canon pieces that people should read if they wish to understand anything about QAnon or about what effect it has on its believers and on the families of its believers. In this particular piece, you talk to a number of people who are the children, mostly the children, and I want to talk about that a little bit more in a second, of people who were desperate believers in QAnon. And of all of the things that you discovered from these chats that you had, what was the one thing that stuck with you? Because this piece you wrote a couple of weeks ago, what's the one thing that still stays with you after talking to all these people?
I think the one thing that stood out to me was how lonely these people feel, these children of QAnon believers, because when you have a parent, someone who raised you, who's so deeply into these conspiracy theories, it can be very isolating. It's not like you can really have an easy conversation with a friend saying, you know, my mom thinks there's a cabal of evil Democrats who drink baby's blood. It can feel very shameful and very embarrassing. And so the people I spoke to have been bottling up a lot of the pain they're going through, and it's still such a stigmatized thing that they really feel like there's no outlet for them to discuss this stuff. So I think that's, in some aspects, the hardest part of losing someone you care about to this stuff.
I think the stigma aspect is a really interesting one, and it's one that you talk a lot about in the piece in terms of having a family member who believes in all this stuff, because the stuff, you know, for the benefit of the very layman who might have just wandered in, hopefully most people already know about QAnon, but if you don't know about QAnon, obviously it is this this belief, this movement centered on the idea that Donald Trump was championing this shadow war against the deep state and liberal elites who rule the world and run a global child sex trafficking ring. And that's just the beginning of it, as you said, you know, drinking baby's blood and Jewish space lasers and various other things. And the beliefs are so, to most rational thinking people, so unbelievably out there that the idea that your mom believes in these things is something that a lot of people find really shameful.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems so ludicrous. And I got a lot of feedback from readers who said, it's hard to believe this is even true, these stories that you're telling, because it's so crazy. Like, how could someone who isn't already crazy buy into this stuff? And I think that's one of the most dangerous parts of QAnon, is just how it kind of burrows its way into your brain and very gradually guides you down the rabbit hole, starting with distorted grains of truth that get exaggerated and exaggerated into these crazy twisted lies. But something important to know about QAnon is it's not only people who are mentally ill or crazy who can buy into this stuff. It's a slow process, and you get into these echo chambers of disinformation, and you're conditioned to be very suspicious of reliable sources of information. And over time, you start to believe things that are patently absurd.
You mentioned two things there that I want to touch on, which you touched on in your piece. And one of them, which I think is one of the most important things in your piece, is not only, as you said, that it's not, you know, mentally ill people who are QAnon believers or not, just, but it's also a question of, I think a lot of people would assume that, I mean, obviously the Venn diagram overlap between QAnon and MAGA is quite big, but we are not talking just about crazy right wingers. We are not talking just about uneducated people. We are talking about all kinds of people from all walks of life. In this piece, you mentioned that a number of the people were people who are two-time Obama voters, people who are educated. And so to make the assumption about these people on any kind of demographic terms is a bit of a fool's errand.
Yeah, definitely. And unfortunately, there isn't much reliable data telling us about QAnon adherents, like who they are. Journalists and researchers have kind of identified that baby boomers who may struggle a little bit with digital literacy are often more susceptible to this stuff. But, you know, QAnon believers, they definitely span generations and different demographics. And it's just, I think a lot of people have fallen into this during the pandemic specifically, because, you know, we're all spending so much more time online right now, and there's so much false information flying around about the crisis and the response to it, that QAnon numbers wise has just exploded over the past year.
It's over. I remember reading, I think it was in 2018 or 2019, there was a reporter, maybe for the New York Times, who was covering a Trump rally. And I remember reading his piece, and he was saying that he was chilled to see the number of, not only the number of QAnon people at the rally, but the people who were unashamedly promoting the fact that they were QAnon. You know, you mentioned in the piece that one of the moms had, you know, a Q sticker on her phone, and that there's actual merch that you can buy. So it's no longer something that people were hiding in the closet, but things that people were quite proudly bearing in front of them.
Yeah, absolutely. QAnon is definitely no longer a strictly online movement. It hasn't been for a while. And even last summer, I live in LA, and I went to cover a QAnon rally that was planned to take place in Hollywood, and I had seen it promoted online. I expected maybe a couple dozen people to show up, but there were easily 1,000 people there marching down Hollywood Wow. Boulevard wearing signs with Pizzagate, like t-shirts with Hillary Clinton like hanging from a noose. It was really scary stuff, and these people, you know, California, maybe shocking to think there could be that many people buying into this far-right conspiracy theory there. But just seeing that show of force really made me realize how much bigger this was than a lot of us believe at this point. So it's definitely something that people are no longer embarrassed to admit they believe in. And, you know, we've seen it mainstreamed into U.S. politics to a large degree at this point.
So now, considering the fact that QAnon has now been with us for enough of a period of time, and considering the fact that it's growing, and considering the fact that many of its disciples and believers are advertising and out there in the mainstream, why is it that we don't have more demographic information about the people who are involved?
I think that for a long time, we just haven't taken it seriously. And I understand toward the beginning, there was a desire to not want to amplify QAnon by giving it undue attention, because it was such a fringe movement. But at this point, I'm hoping that researchers and the government will be paying a lot more attention to QAnon and putting a lot more resources into tracking and understanding and addressing the threat it poses, especially after the riot at the Capitol. You know, a lot of those people, as we're now learning, were avid QAnon believers. And so hopefully there will be more research done. Hopefully we'll get a better understanding of who these people are and how they get into this. But right now, not having that information makes it hard to even understand where to focus our help right now.
You make an interesting point, and it's one I think I made on this show before, which is the difficulty that is posed when you cover a group like QAnon, which mirrors a little bit of the trouble when it came to covering Trump, which is that if you make the effort to call out all of the BS, if you make the effort to sort of go into this, you're also, you know, as a collateral damage, giving more exposure to potentially harmful issues and claims, et cetera.
Yeah, definitely. And that was, you know, I've been tracking QAnon since at least early 2018. It's only been around since late 2017. But For a while, it was just kind of observing from afar without wanting to give it too much air, because the more people know about it, the more people can get into it. But I think the time QAnon really started blowing up was when we started seeing these Q signs and flags at Trump rallies. And at this point, I assume most Americans know what QAnon is and are at least vaguely familiar with it. The scary thing, I think, too, is even though, you know, so many people buy into these conspiracy theories, I don't think all of them, if they were surveyed or polled, would identify as a QAnon believer. So even though they may not say, I believe in Q and I check for Q drops, I think a lot more people than we realize are embracing these conspiracy theories. And obviously, there are very real world consequences to this level of disinformation.
Well, conspiracy theories, as you and I know, are nothing new, right? They've been around forever and ever, not forever and ever, but they certainly are something that has taken hold quite a bit more. Of course, I'm Canadian, right? And you live in Los Angeles now. Am I a fool for saying that conspiracy theories do seem to have a greater hold in the U.S.? They do seem to have a bit more traction when it comes to the American psyche. Is that me being foolish, or is there some truth to that?
No, I think you're definitely right. I'm actually Canadian as well. I'm a dual citizen, so I spend some time back in Canada with my family. And
so you're a double agent. You can tell us exactly what's going on here.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, QAnon has taken a hold a little bit in Canada, I think more in Quebec from what I've read, but it's definitely not comparable to the level of conspiracy theories and disinformation we're seeing in the States. And I think part of that, at least why we're seeing it over the past few years, is that Trump has amplified this stuff, especially, you know, QAnon views Trump as a savior. Trump is supposed to save the world from this cabal of satanic pedophiles. And so when he kind of tacitly, like, nodded and winked at some of QAnon's conspiracy theories toward, like, during his election campaign, that really drew more people into the movement and emboldened QAnon believers. And so we in Canada, we don't see Trudeau doing that stuff. We don't see really the level of high endorsement in Canada and elsewhere in the world. So I think that's one big factor as to why this has gained so much ground in the States.
Although we in Canada are definitely far from innocent when it comes to this kind of thing. Anyone like you who covers this sort of thing knows that a large number of extreme right-wing figures in the United States have been grown here in Canada and exported south of the border. So we have a certain amount of responsibility to bear with that as well. One of the things that struck me when I was reading your piece, how many of these family members did you talk to?
Nine.
You talked to nine. I am older than you. I think it's safe to assume that I am older than you. And so I kind of came of age during the 80s and 90s, which was, of course, the heyday of cults and, you know, David Koresh and the Moonies and all that kind of a thing. And one of the things that was quite common at the time was parents watching out for their children being drawn into cults. Whereas when I'm reading your piece, it's actually a little bit of the opposite. It's virtually every single one of these people talking about their parents. Why do you think that is? I mean, here I am, you know, I guess semi-accidentally referring to QAnon as a cult, but at the same time, it's the idea of being indoctrinated into this thing, which is spouting a lot of nonsense. And here you have children trying to save their parents, which is the flip side of what it was 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, I certainly would call QAnon a cult, but it is interesting. The people I spoke to, it's like they're in this reverse role of having to teach their parents true from false and right from wrong. And that's, of course, not an easy thing to do. But I think part of it is that factor of, for some baby boomers, just not having the digital literacy skills to be able to discern what is fake news and what is a reliable
right
article, what's a trustworthy news source. But I did get a lot of feedback after the piece published from people saying, I lost my kid to QAnon, and you should cover that aspect too. So it is important to note that this spans generations, but from the research that's been done by people like Travis View, some people may be familiar with him. He's one of the leading QAnon researchers.
Right.
It does seem like there are a lot more baby boomers into this conspiracy theory movement than people from other age groups.
I think you're right. You speculated that it might also be because of the fact that they are not quite as digital native as younger people are. And so many of the safeguards that many younger people have grown up with in terms of differentiating right from wrong in an online world are not as native to them as they are for you or I, maybe.
Right.
You also found this subreddit, QAnon Casualties, which is a Reddit community where friends and spouses and relatives of QAnon believers come together to vent and to commiserate. And in your piece, you include this bar graph that shows the exponential growth of this subreddit since it was founded in June or July of last year, and now it has over 100,000 subscribers who come together to sort of say, What can we do?
Yeah, it's kind of wild how QAnon casualties blew up. As far as I know, it's one of the only real support networks for people who have lost loved ones to this stuff. And it was created in summer of 2019, only had a few hundred subscribers for months and months and months. And then towards the beginning of the pandemic, you really start to see that incline of people flooding here looking for resources. And I think it really shows how few resources there are for people going through this and how popular QAnon became over these past few months, because that really, without the data from other places to track QAnon, you have to look at stuff like this, like the metrics of a QAnon support group. And it is pretty staggering to see that growth from a few hundred to well over 130,000 now.
Do you have you heard of Stephen Hassan?
Yes, I have. I've spoken with him. He's really great.
One of the things that I found fascinating for the listeners, Stephen Hassan is a former member of the Unification Church. He's a member of the Moonies. He's the author of a book called Combating Mind Control. And consequently, since QAnon has really been in the fore, he's been in a lot of media. He's been asked to be interviewed in a lot of places. I stumbled upon a piece that he wrote for CNN called I Was a Member of a Cult, Here's How to Bring QAnon Believers Back to Reality. And he takes it kind of point by point. And the points are: reach out, offer sources, suggest a break from the media, be willing to listen. And all of these things, while really good, after reading your piece, you kind of realize don't really do anything. And that it, when I looked at those, I'm like, those are great ideas, but it seems like all of those have been debunked, no?
Yeah, that was, I wish I could have ended my piece on a more positive note, but all the people I spoke to said they've tried everything with their parents and nothing has worked. They believe in QAnon like they believe in God, and it's obviously not an easy thing to shake someone from their religion. You know, QAnon sort of becomes part of your identity. And so I think the one thing that kind of pulled a few QAnon believers back to reality was Biden's inauguration. Q had kind of prophesied that Biden's inauguration was going to be the Great Awakening, this big event where all the evildoers, the deep state actors, would be brought to justice and arrested and possibly executed. And so the QAnon community was so, so excited. It was this day they'd been waiting for months, or for some of them years. And of course, that didn't happen. Biden was inaugurated without issue. And so for some people, that was a wake-up call. And they, you know, I'm speaking to a few QAnon, former QAnon believers right now, who that's what it took to shake them out of this.
I mean, I do know that a lot of people left the movement after the inauguration, and a lot of people were disillusioned. You wrote a great piece about QAnon believers grappling with the inauguration and trying to figure out what went so horribly wrong. But as you mentioned, a lot of them, as the inauguration went off, as it was supposed to have gone off, were sort of like, well, I mean, many of them were thinking that it was a deepfaked video, that it didn't actually happen, that Biden was safely in custody somewhere, as you say, continually moving the goalposts. One of the things that I just, and I honestly cannot get enough of this in the horrible way, is seeing all of the sort of screenshots from chat rooms on Inauguration Day as people sort of slowly were saying, what is going on? Because they were, of course, expecting Trump to come running down the aisle in a Superman cape and arresting people and everything else. And they were just like, this, what's going on? They couldn't grapple with it.
Yeah, so many of these QAnon believers have really, really isolated themselves from their friends and their family, who think they're crazy and can't relate to their intense anger over problems that don't exist, like a hoax pandemic and a vaccine with a microchip. So when you totally embrace these conspiracy theories and absorb yourself into them, you push away so many of the people who care about you, and then you're desperately waiting for this big moment of reckoning. And when it doesn't happen, I think for a lot of them, it shatters their world. Like, yeah, I was hanging out in a bunch of QAnon group chats on Inauguration Day and kind of taking screenshots of what I was seeing and putting them into this article. And just the level of despair was, you know, heartbreaking, because they've already isolated themselves, and now this desperate idea they've been clinging to falls apart. And so I think some of them, it drove them even deeper into the movement, because how do you go back from that? How do you say, sorry, family, I have been acting horribly over the past while for this big thing that never happened. Like, can we be cool again?
Right. I mean, the problem is that things like this are so sticky, right? Conspiracy theories, once they're in somebody's head, can really stay there. And one of the, I guess, the most insidious things when it comes to QAnon is that the people who are trying to debunk these conspiracy theories, sort of pragmatists like me with a tiny voice, or somebody like you with resources at your ability and a bit of a larger megaphone, these are precisely the people that believers have been told to distrust.
Right. QAnon believers have been conditioned to interpret any opposition as validation. So fact checkers, you know, what are their motivations? They're wondering, like, do they work for the deep state and why are they trying to hide the truth? And journalists, of course, were part of the like the evil mainstream media. And so that's why QAnon is as effective as it is. It seeds this doubt of all credible information sources. And when you can't trust anyone, what do? Like, you buy into more and more of these conspiracy theories, and that's how it gets to the level that it's at now.
Right, is that these things are kind of they're organized to resist debunking, in the sense that anybody who says something which is contradictory to your way of thinking is obviously against you and is obviously wrong and is obviously part of the thing that you are fighting against. But then, as you mentioned, once, you know, this thing fails to materialize on the date that you have predicted, this kind of thing means it is almost bulletproof.
Yeah, it is. It's, I think, to get out of QAnon, you really have to want to do that yourself. I don't know if there is going to be any effective intervention strategy by family members, because the ones I talked to said they tried it all. They tried debunking, obviously, it didn't help. They tried being patient and just sitting and listening and trying to be open-minded, hoping that the QAnon parent would then do the same. And that didn't work. Some people have just had to cut their parents out of their lives because it's too hard to deal with. So I don't know that there is any effective strategy. I think the best thing you can do if you have a loved one who's fallen into QAnon is just try to be really compassionate, as hard as that may feel sometimes. Just, you know, you have to give the person an incentive to come back to reality. And if you're not going to embrace them and be kind, then they're probably not ever coming back.
Right. I mean, I talked, you know, a few minutes ago about the cults of the 70s and 80s. And one of the biggest ideas around that time was the idea of deprogramming, right? Once you get somebody out of the Moonies, or once you get somebody out of whatever cult they've been taken into, you have to then deprogram them to get them back into real world. And there were people who made their livings as deprogrammers. There were films made about that kind of thing. But what do you do when you have millions of people across an entire country who all have to be deprogrammed? I mean, there's really no way that this can be done. I mean, it's a bit of a pessimistic way of looking at this. But even though you have the person who had the largest megaphone, Trump, who is now has, you know, obviously a smaller megaphone and can't get the message out there as much, you still have Fox News. You still have Tucker Carlson, who I think just literally last night said that QAnon didn't exist on his show. He said that, hold on, what's the quote? "We spent all day trying to locate the famous QAnon, which in the end we learned is not even a website. If it's out there, we could not find it." And so you have, you know, one of the most popular news organizations in the world telling people that this doesn't even exist. Like, where do you go? What do you do?
Yeah, there seems to be an effort to kind of make it seem like all this concern about QAnon is just baseless hysteria and, you know, people trying to fearmonger, which of course we've already seen what QAnon is capable of. We've already seen the real world impacts of this stuff. So hopefully the media, Tucker Carlson excluded, will continue to recognize that this is an urgent and serious issue and continue to investigate the role that, like, big tech companies and the GOP have played in fostering QAnon's rise. And there have been a lot of experts calling on the Biden administration to invest in de-radicalization initiatives, which hopefully we see happen soon.
Well, that's the other problem. You just touched on it there, which is that when you have a two-party system and one of those parties disproportionately benefits from the existence of QAnon, obviously it's a double-edged sword and it cuts in two ways, but obviously you're going to get more benefits for the GOP, for QAnon, then you're not going to have the same amount of passion to do something about it from the entire body of Congress.
Yeah, and that's the really troubling part. And I think that's why we saw Trump repeatedly declining to condemn QAnon when given the opportunity, because QAnon did a lot for him. They held him up as a hero and they spread disinformation that benefited him while he was running for president and the party more broadly. So it is going to take serious effort and concern from both sides to deal with this. And until then, it's only going to continue to grow.
So let's try to end this segment on as positive a note as we can, even if it's a hypothetical one, which is this: as somebody who has reported on this stuff a lot and probably knows a lot more about this than most of us will ever forget, if you could pick one strategy, one thing that you could do to help curb the threat to truthfulness, the threat to democracy, the threat to, you know, Western society that QAnon poses, what would you start with? Obviously, we have a lot of things that could potentially be done. What do you think is the most powerful weapon in our arsenal to combat the danger posed by a group like QAnon?
Personally, just having seen so many strategies fail, I think what I would say is human connection. You know, reach out to the people you know, and you may be surprised to find that some of your friends or family members are getting into this stuff. They may not be all the way at the level of Democrats eating babies, but, you know, they could be on their way here. And so I think that the most effective thing to try to steer someone off this path is having a person they love come and try to help them. That's going to be more effective than any article I write trying to debunk this stuff or any fact check on Facebook. So really check in with the people you care about, see how they're doing. And if you recognize any of these signs, try to have a real conversation with them about why they believe this stuff, how they got into it, and why it's not true.
Thing two. Thing number two, social media is still trying to get a handle on misinformation, especially when it comes to the vaccine. We are this is almost a weekly ongoing updated story. So here we are at the end of February. Jesselyn, where are we? What is going on now when it comes to Instagram, when it comes to Facebook, when it comes to Twitter and Google, all trying to get a handle on misinformation, in particular about the vaccine? Where are we going? What is happening as of right now?
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's still a mess. And I think we have, for years, people have been pushing on these big social media giants to take misinformation seriously. And it wasn't until the pandemic that we started seeing really concrete commitments to tackle this stuff. Even Mark Zuckerberg, CEO of Facebook, at the start of the pandemic, made some unprecedented steps to try to tackle mis and disinformation on his platform. But it's been a lot of empty words so far. You know, Facebook and Instagram, Facebook owns Instagram, I should say. The two of them in particular have been really awful at addressing vaccine falsehoods from my experience reporting on this stuff. And Facebook first committed to tackling vaccine misinfo in February of 2019. So that was a long time ago. And then time after time, they would come back and they'd say, we're working on this more, we're going to keep improving. But even today, if you find an anti-vax account on Instagram, of which there are plenty, and you follow it, Instagram will then automatically line up a bunch more anti-vax accounts for you to continue to follow. So their algorithms are bringing this stuff to you like on a conveyor belt, it seems. And so, of course, it's important to recognize that these platforms profit from this stuff, but it's really, really disheartening to see in the middle of this crisis we're in, vaccine misinformation in particular is still such a horrible issue.
Just sticking with Facebook and Instagram for a second, would you say that by far the number one problem when it comes to combating this stuff is, if you're going to put it as simply as possible, the algorithm? Would you say that that is the main problem?
In my opinion, it is. It's one thing to ask these platforms not to host bad content at all. You can say, like, I want to see an outright ban on vaccine misinformation. I don't want to see it on Facebook at all. Or, you know, I think the bigger problem is when Facebook is bringing it to you and saying, hey, look at this, like, why don't you follow this page? Or why don't you check out these anti-vax accounts? So when the platforms are playing an active role in putting this misinformation in front of its users, that's when I think it's a, like, we're seeing the complicity there. However, algorithms, yeah, I think that's the main issue, but also groups on Facebook have been a big problem too, these private groups where misinformation spreads like crazy.
And as you said, you know, as we mentioned in the last bit, you have, you know, an organization like Fox News, which I don't know if you saw in Business Insider, Tom Porter was reporting on the fact that Fox News, since Biden took over, have started attacking vaccines again, probably in an attempt to discredit the administration after he took the rollout from Trump, that they noted the fact that the attacks on vaccines went down quite a bit last summer when Trump was pushing for it. But now that it is Biden, attacks by Tucker Carlson et al. Have ramped up quite significantly.
I hadn't seen that report, but it doesn't surprise me. And that's really sad to hear everything being politicized when we are in a very deadly crisis. The conspiracy theories we've seen forming from vaccines, too, have kind of changed recently. It used to be like vaccine misinformation has been around forever, right? It used to be mostly that vaccines cause autism, which of course isn't true. But now we're not just seeing health misinformation on the rise. We're seeing conspiracy theories about the supposedly nefarious motivations of people involved in the vaccines development and distribution, Bill Gates, the World Health Organization. So it's becoming a whole new monster to address. And seeing people promote skepticism of vaccines for political reasons is incredibly troubling.
The thing that I find craziest about some of those, and one of the main ones that I think you're probably touching on, is the idea that the vaccine is, we're all going to be getting a tracking chip embedded in all of us. This, of course, goes back to QAnon a little bit as well, that all of us, as we get the vaccine, is it's their way of inserting this tracking chip into our bodies. But the thing that I find ironic about that is anyone who believes in that probably read it on their cell phone, which they are carrying with them at all times, which is a tracking chip which they are currently existing with on a 24-hour basis.
Yeah, of course. That's the deep irony. That conspiracy theory you mentioned, I think, is one of the most prominent conspiracy theories surrounding the vaccine. And it's wild that people are at a level where we're buying into this stuff, but here we are.
The tricky part is that companies like Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and even Google, they make money off of this stuff, right? I mean, the algorithm does not exist to be evil. The algorithm exists to earn money. Any media is a business. There is nothing wrong with a media being a business. You work for a media outlet, which is a business, and that is completely fine. However, the question now is, at what point is your social responsibility greater than your responsibility to your shareholders? And that's becoming a bit more of a question now.
Yeah, I think we've consistently seen that companies like Facebook and others only implement change when there's a threat to their bottom line, which is why reporting on their failures to address misinformation is so important, because that's what really puts it in the public eye and puts pressure on the company. But yeah, these algorithms, you know, they exist to keep you scrolling. They want to take you down these rabbit holes where you're going to be seeing more and more of what the algorithm thinks interests you. And if that's anti-vax content, you're going to be seeing a lot of that, because the longer you're on the platform, the more ads you're going to see and the more money the company's going
to
make.
Now, you actually reported on this late last year. You talked, Instagram had made a pledge to counter vaccine misinformation. And you actually did a little experiment yourself, right? You followed some Instagram. You followed a single anti-vax account. Is that right?
Yeah, that's all it takes. You find one anti-vax account on Instagram, you follow it, and then Instagram recommends a bunch more for you because it's recognized that you have at least some degree of interest in this stuff. And if that's going to keep you around, then it'll shove you down.
It's also just a reminder of, obviously, the two solitudes that exist within social media. I remember after Trump was elected in 2016, seeing a headline, you know, the next day that said something like, I think the headline was something along the lines of, last night, you know, 100 or however many million people voted for Donald Trump, and I don't know a single one of them. The point of the piece being that, of course, if you exist within your bubble on Facebook or Twitter or wherever, you are not seeing any of these people and you are not experiencing any of the same thing that they are experiencing, and vice versa.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a bunch of different Facebook and Instagram accounts because I try to see what it's like to be inside those bubbles. So I have Instagram accounts where I only follow anti-vax misinformation. I have Facebook accounts where I only follow far-right pages and try to immerse myself in the world and see what other people are looking at. And it is crazy that you can have just such a completely different experience on the same platform, because once you start following these pages, the platforms will drive you towards more and more content of that nature. And, you know, I'm sure your Facebook account looks a lot different than mine, but when you're really getting into these hyper-political spaces, it's just wild. It's like night and day.
One of the things I stumbled upon is that anti-vaxxers are actually targeting Christians on social media quite a bit. They are saying that, you know, not only is it microchips, et cetera, but the false claims that the vaccines are containing fetal tissue. And what they're doing is they're kind of free-forming their own algorithms in terms of who they should be focusing with some of this misinformation.
Yeah, conspiracy theorists and conspiracy theory movements are very skilled at kind of choosing their target audience and merging their ideas with existing ideologies and kind of recognizing what people care about and what they're concerned about and how they can morph that into a new threat or fear. So that doesn't surprise me. And, you know, the anti-vax movement has kind of bled into so many different spaces, and QAnon in particular has steered it in some really frightening directions.
So now here we are at the end of February, and the White House has been reaching out to all kinds of social media companies, Facebook, Twitter, Alphabet, et cetera, trying to sort of get their help in stopping COVID misinformation from going viral. What do you think their chances of success are? I guess that the second part of that question is, do you feel like these companies are keen to get on board, or are they going to be reluctant participants in this exercise?
I mean, hopefully at this point, we'll see some more willingness to cooperate. And I know that, you know, Facebook, for example, has given a lot of free advertising credit to organizations like the World Health Organization to get pro-vaccine messaging out there. So that's definitely something, and I hope it'll make a difference. One strategy I saw being kind of debated on Twitter, which I thought was interesting, is that on these social spaces, influencers have so much power and so much influence over people. And so kind of investing in some pro-vaccine influencers might actually sway the public perception around this stuff. So there's a lot of different avenues being explored right now, and hopefully the social media companies will cooperate at this level and try to change the narrative, because the level of vaccine hesitancy right now is just very dangerous.
Yeah, I think there's an old famous expression that says that vaccines don't work, vaccination works. And that is ultimately, I think, the issue at play right now. I haven't seen what the latest stats are in terms of people who are willing to, you know, step up and get the vaccine, but it's the last ones I saw were not terribly promising.
No, and the concerning thing is that there's a startling level of vaccine hesitancy among healthcare workers too, and I think that shows.
Is that right?
Yeah, it is. It's very unsettling, and I think it just goes to show that these conspiracy theories and misinformation can really get to anyone. Like, you know, nurses are on their phones looking at social media too, and I think in this case, I think from the studies I've read, the term healthcare worker is quite broad, but no one is immune to this stuff.
Wow. So, okay. So if there's a path forward, I mean, obviously Biden and the White House are trying to do something. They're taking this seriously, but taking this seriously is only a single step. Reaching out to Facebook and Twitter is only a single step. In terms of actual boots on the ground, what can be done here? What would you say is like the most important place for them to start in combating COVID misinformation and anti-vax misinformation?
I think it is the social media platforms. I think that's where so much of this stuff begins and gains ground and takes off. And, you know, being locked down, we are all spending so much time on our screens. And
right.
I think, yeah, starting with the social media companies and going from there is the real way to address this.
And that will do it for this week's show. Jesselyn, thank you so much for being on the show. Do you have socials where you would like people to follow you?
Oh, sure. My Twitter is @JessReports. And thank you so much for having me on, Don.
No problem. And I will say that if anyone is interested in these topics, such as QAnon conspiracies, technology, politics, anti-vax, etc., Jesselyn is a fantastic person to follow who's doing really, really good work that I can very highly, highly recommend, written very well. So go follow her right now if you want to keep up on all this stuff. Thanks for being on the show, Jess.
Thank you so much.
Hey, what's the most interesting thing you've seen on the internet this week? Fact? Article? Something else? We want it. Email us at 3interestingthings@gmail.com. Follow our Instagram at 3, that's the number 3, interesting things. Or tweet it to us at 3interesting. You'll get a shout out on the show. Hey, if you're enjoying the podcast, head on over to Apple Podcasts and give us a rating or review. It really helps people find the show. We'll see you next week.